Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy. Once again, we are talking about how recruiting works, this time with Loyola head coach Charlie Toomey. Coach Toomey, thanks so much for joining.
Terry, always great to have you home, buddy.
It's well said. We're here in the Ridley Athletic Complex. I think I'm in this office maybe for the first time, which is crazy because you've been here for what, 14, 15, well, 12 years?
2012.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, about 13 years.
Yeah.
Sure. Hey, I remember you up on main campus.
Exactly.
I remember you as a student athlete coming up and sitting.
Student reporter. Student, very much not an athlete.
But I do remember you you played the game.
Yes.
And you would have very pointed lacrosse questions to me, you know, as a member of the Greyhound staff.
We'll get into that in a little bit. But first, I want to start this podcast the same way we always do, which is how do you characterize the role that recruiting plays in your program and your approach to building the program?
You know, I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, we all have, and, you know, the word that kind of keeps coming out is it's the lifeblood of your program. That is the reality of it. I would tell you that, you know, for us being a school that, you know, might be a little smaller than some other ones, I think the biggest thing for us is that we have to get to know the kids. We have to get to know what the pulse is, you know, what the market is, what they want out of an experience. And so I would tell you that it's kind of evolved for me in terms of, you know, how I evaluate, how I, you know, get to know the kids and the questions that I'm asking them. It's been a, like I said, an evolving process that, I think what was happening in 10, 15 years ago is just very different these days and ages, you know, making sure that you're creating that relationship. Because to me, the biggest thing I can do is have a young man come to campus, but also get to know that person and then show them what makes Loyola special.
Totally. You just mentioned it, so let's dive into the second topic, which is how do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
Evolving.
Well, yes, fair. All right.
Evolving. And I say that because, you know, a lot of times you evolve, you have a new coordinator, right? Whether or not for us there are changes have been over time on the offensive side. And when you're bringing, you know, new staff into the mix and you're talking about, you know, the type of kids that you're looking for, you know, you want to make sure that you're just not going after the best players. When I first got here, it was let's identify the best talent that we could, and let's try and, you know, get our locker room in a position where we're just better. We're better with, you know, athletically, skills. And now I would tell you that we are looking probably more for, yes, the character side of things and peeling the onion back, talking to club coaches and evaluating that side of it. But we have a really detailed plan as to what we're looking for. You know, we want lefties, we want righties, and we want a quarterback below goal line. We want alpha middies. We want downhill dodgers. We want the hammer, that stretch shooter offensively. And so we're kind of trying to categorize a little bit more for them. But certainly myself and even having staffs, it's always interesting to me that coaches, they evaluate probably to the player that they were, right? And so, you know, like I said, in Coach Dwan's case, he wants that super skilled guy between the lines that can kind of push, the Scott Ratliff type of guy, right?
Totally.
And so that's the type of player he's looking for. I think watching, you know, Justin Ward, he's looking for that quarterback, you know, that has the ability to throw it to a lefty or a righty, so where he had a lot of success here. And so, you know, it's changed. You know, for myself, I see everything from the goal out. And so that might be different than some other coaches that may have been offensive guys. I look at, you know, starting in the goal, what I'm trying to evaluate, how I'm evaluating it, things that are really important to me. But then the transition game and what it looks like from the goal out going to the other end. And then it's my job to make sure that, you know, my coordinators are identifying and bringing, you know, quality young men to campus, and then it's just showing them who we are.
I want to follow up on the comment about goalies. I feel like in these conversations, we haven't actually talked that much about recruiting goalies, and I think that relative to every other position, it's unique because there is a I always say that there's a spectrum of production to evaluating athletic attributes. And from a goalie standpoint, that's true, but the athletic attributes are not, you know, explosiveness or strength or speed or whatever. It's much more so about either reaction, or it's less about the athletic attributes and it's more about the style. So I guess my first question in terms of how you look at goalies is, do you believe that there is a right and wrong way to play the position? And if so, do you effectively eliminate recruiting somebody that you think plays the position the wrong way, even if you're impressed by how productive he is?
It's a great question. I'm trying to bring guys here that I know I can take their game to another level, right? So I have my non-negotiables, and some of those are going to be just kind of, you know, your ready position, your set position before a shot is taken. Is there a lot of wasted movement, right? Like, some of those things are a little bit more difficult to fix. But I think we all want leaders. We want to see a guy that projects, a guy that, you know, has an air of confidence in the goal. So that those are, I watch the games, but I watch their warmups. And in club games, usually it's a player that's just sent out there, and I can learn more in a warmup than I probably can just in a game. Because the highlight films, we're going to get, you very rarely see goals going in a highlight. You're seeing the best of what they're going to bring to it. But I want to hear them. Eyes on is really, really important in that position. And again, we've had bigger goalies, we've had smaller goalies, and I would tell you some of our best goalies have been bigger ones where they have very little wasted movement. You're forcing a shooter to shoot for net. And so I'm looking for that. But the one caveat that I really believe in is, you know, no false movement and your ability to catch the ball cleanly. And so that's what, that comes down to hand positioning, that comes down to kind of, are you turning your hips or are you kind of stepping square behind the ball? Little nuances that I think we can fix, but how much do we need to fix when they get here?
So I guess, and I don't even know if the position is still taught this way, but, you know, I was taught basically like low, mid, high arc, right? And so I, you know, kind of conceive of it as like, are you taking 3 steps to get from one pipe to the other? Are you taking 5 steps? Are you taking 7 steps? And I think it's always, now that I'm like kind of processing it, thinking about the goalies that you've had, you've been, like, to your point about non-wasted movement, pretty low arc goalies. Like Jack Runkle was a like 2 to 3 step goalie getting from one pipe to the other. Even Jacob Stover, who wasn't as physically big as Jack, was still like a very kind of low arc type of player. And it strikes me, is that part of the preference? Is that kind of what you're explaining?
Yeah, well, when they get here, you're going to watch them and you're going to work with them, right? And you do have some high arc goalies, and you're just trying to, you're trying to point out the significance of ball movement and being out of position. And so I feel like if you can have the ability to start a little bit flatter, you can take the cheat step, right? Like, they show it to that velocity shooter out top, and now that's a chance to step and present and be big and show less net. So that's, I don't look for a particular type of style. I certainly don't. I don't think anybody wants the guy that's at the top of the arc or ending up out at the end of the crease.
Or at his knees all the time.
Or at his knees, right, for sure. The one thing I always will say is, the flatter you are, the more reaction time, right? And I think that that's, you know, the way that, you know, the velocity of the shots now, the equipment, the you know, technology is very different. You know, it was very easy for me with a Sam and a Barney and no offset heads to kind of get a good read and to probably stand in there and be a little higher. Being flatter, I think that reaction time is critical, but you still, what does your first step look like? Are you opening up your hips or are you stepping square to the shooter? And that's the coaching points.
Did you play with a Goalmaster?
The STX 00, yeah. But I remember having a goalie, my first STX stick was the old triangle.
Yeah.
Stick triangle with leather.
Yep.
You know, on the inside. So, yeah, it's coming a long way.
Yeah. I was, I think I started with a Goalmaster and then I ended up playing with an Eclipse. That was my era. But anyhow, opening up the conversation a little bit, I joke, I don't like to have the podcast before the podcast. So we're going to have a mini production meeting and the audience gets to hear it. One of the things that I think has made this podcast series so popular is the relationships that I have with a lot of your peers and the ability that gives me to ask more pointed questions than somebody else might. And that is no more, I don't know, I have not known a college lacrosse coach longer than I've known you. And so as a result, I would assume that gives me that ability to in greater numbers. I think what's most interesting about the conversation that you and I can have is about the evolution and talking specifically about some of the moments in the evolutionary point that you referenced previously. And so there, whenever you talk about, you know, two decades, it's you can kind of break it down in whatever increments you want. I think generally I kind of would think about it in like 5-year increments, but I think about recruiting at Loyola way more as like a binary of kind of pre-Patriot League and post-Patriot League. And the thing about that is that that coincides with two other really important factors, pre-stadium and post-stadium, and pre-national championship and post-national championship. So let's just dive in a little bit on what recruiting was like from 2006 when you took over through 2012, and just kind of describe what some of the, and I kind of, this is really important too. It's a little bit, it's not totally pre-early recruiting, post-early recruiting, but that was another factor in how it fit in. So how do you describe the first 6 or 7 years of recruiting to Loyola?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, I would say that a lot of the relation, we as coaches, when I was first starting, we had the ability to be hands-on. You know, I remember camps like 205 and Champ Camp, and I have been a high school coach, right? So I knew some of the important, you know, recruiting places, venues that we had to send the guys, but it was very different, right? There was maybe 4 or 5 of them. You had to go to Blue Chip way back when.
Totally. Right?
And see those kids. But here at Loyola, being on staff with Coach Cottle, and then, you know, as Coach had gone down to Maryland, the top 205 camp where you actually coached the kids, and there was a college night, and it was like speed dating. They would come to the table and you'd have all of your information, and you were really trying to impress upon them in a small window of what was going to make you different, right? And that was probably some of your first conversations. And then the era of, you know, towards the back end of it, now I'm the head coach. It was really trying to identify what type of player we wanted to attract to the program. We wanted to become more athletic. We felt like we wanted to have, we weren't in the let's play fast phase yet, but we wanted athletes. We wanted to try and to be able to compete a little bit better athletically. And that was really, really important to us. Let's take the best guy we can in this moment. Let's you know, academically, let's vet them, make sure that they fit our culture, fit what we're trying to do. But I used to say to the teams on day one, listen, I've been a captain. I've been in your shoes. We're doing this together. I'm young. I'm going to make mistakes, but we're going to get there together. Right. And so it was a kind of an unproven, those kids were taking a chance on a guy that was an assistant coach being elevated, but they knew my heart was Loyola and that we were going to fight. We were going to start. That's where probably the blue collar mentality, you know, was brought into play. And I'd like to believe that we've kind of continued with that. But then towards the tail end of it, you know, again, you have relationships in coaching. And I can remember you talk about 2012, but a Josh Hawkins is playing up in New England and we're recruiting him to be a middie. Davis Butts is up in New England. We're recruiting him to be a D middie. And I probably don't know Josh as well until John Tillman, close friend of mine, calls me at Harvard and says, you ought to really take a look at this kid. And we knew our battles, you know, were going to be with Coach Cottle down at Maryland on that one. And so, you know, you have staff that kind of, they understand Loyola. They understand what we stand for, kind of the type of program we are, the commitment. And the other staffs might say, listen, you should look at this kid. We really like him, but it might not work athletically or academically for them. Take a look, see if it works for you. And so, you know, I think everybody as coaches has tended to bunker in a little bit more with the staff, and there's probably less communication there. There's less venues to really sit on the sidelines and coach with other guys. You're actually sitting there and evaluating with other coaches. So I would say that, you know, early on, it was recruiting to a program that had had success, but it was trying to we were going to find our way under Charlie Toomey, and they were going to grow with me as a young coach, and You know, I was very blessed to have the staff that I did right away with Bobby Benson, you know, kind of leading the charge offensively and then transitioning over to Danny Shamati. And anytime you're the head coach and you've got good coordinators, you kind of let them go and you see what they want to bring to the table, right? You know, in the recruiting process. And both of them excellent in their own way, excellent in the living room, excellent, you know, in the boardroom as to what they think we need here as a program. And what my challenge as a coach to do in that moment is, okay, this is the type of coordinator that I have. I can go from being a good cop or a bad cop. I might have to be a little more loud, or I might have to kind of back off. And watching us grow and develop as a staff, as Danny was here for a few years, I was able to kind of take that step back and let him kind of almost show those head coach qualities that he was having with us. But I'll never forget, we're playing Notre Dame in Josh's freshman year. And I said to Dan, I call a timeout. I'm like, give him the ball. I don't care if he's a DM. He's going to run. We're going to run a mumbo. And he's like, coach, he's going to throw it to the wrong guy. And I'm like, I don't care. He's the only guy that's going to run by somebody. And he did. And he threw it to the wrong guy. And that's the last time I've ever walked to the offensive end and said, this is what I want offensively in this moment. But he kind of, we both knew, you know, that, well, we've got a good one here, right? And again, ultimately, Davis Butts becomes a middie, Josh becomes a D-middie, and it kind of changes their trajectory a little bit for the program that moment in time in 2012.
Totally. I was actually going to ask about Josh specifically. You brought up Scott Ratliff. I'm interested in him from the standpoint of what that meant for your willingness to take a chance on somebody from a non-traditional area.
Yeah, I was very, I was fortunate enough with Coach Tillman. We were running a camp at one time, and we did it down in Atlanta. We weren't sure how many teams were going to be there. And, you know, Walton High School was there. I got to meet, you know, through a good friend of mine and a loyal alum, John Holthouse, who was a big part of the Thunder program before it became the Thunder. He was kind of running a club program down there. And, you know, we had eight teams, but we watched Scott Ratliff, you know, play long pole, run to the sideline, get a short stick, you know, go down and play offense. And it was like, this kid's really athletic, but I'm just not sure with our numbers. And, you know, he kind of goes through the process and he's going to a service academy and makes a decision. I'm not so sure this is for me. I could kind of easily go back through my recollection of, you know, fall recruiting. Actually, it was in the summer, and said, you know, I think this is a guy that I really like, and we should bring to campus and see if it's a fit. And I think he again fit what we were looking for. He wore Atlanta on his sleeve, and that's the one thing anybody that knows Scott Ratliff knows. You know, maybe I wasn't recruited, you know, to some of the bigger schools, but I'm gonna go prove a lot of people wrong. And we were able to kind of capitalize on that. And you know, great leader, you know, great talented player, and just kind of, you know, wore Atlanta on his sleeve every day in practice and helped us to take it to a whole nother level here at Loyola.
And then the last guy from that era that I want to ask about is Justin Ward, particularly from the lens of one of the things that makes Loyola what it is its location in one of the hotbeds of lacrosse. And obviously you're from here, so you're intimately familiar with that. Justin is from here as well, but he went to Old Mill High School, which is not a powerhouse. What was it like finding him, and what was it like convincing him that Loyola was the best fit?
Well, yeah, you're right. It wasn't a situation where you're sitting as probably as quickly to sit in the Old Mill stands as you still are, you know, to go to Delaney and Severna Park and some of the other public schools. So we saw him play with his club team, and he had a very successful, you know, program with Lee Corrigan's group.
Rough Riders, yeah.
The Rough Riders. And so we probably noticed him there, but he also played with a team that, not a club team back then, that not a lot of people knew, the Rockfish with Steve Spence. And we followed the Rockfish all the way up to Rutgers for their MVP camp way back when, and really just tried to track him and watch him and how he played. And we felt like, you know, there's a good one there, and we've got to do our job of trying to keep this young man home. And, you know, I'm not so sure. You'd have to talk to Justin about his recruiting process, because we really don't get into the minutia. Certainly back then, we're going to show you who we are. Don't really care who else is recruiting. The most important thing, and to this day, is get them to campus. Let him see this. Let him get a feel for it. Let him learn who he's playing for. And I think from that, from day one, you know, his process was a good one, was an easy one for us. It was an easy fit from our side. We loved how he presented himself. You could kind of look at a young man and say, he's got a chance to be a coach someday. You know, the way he sees the field, the way he communicates, looks you in the eye, he's going to be a good one. And lo and behold, you know, he's here and 1 year to grow up. And then next year, he's got the keys of the car.
Right.
He's got the keys of the car, throwing it to Sawyer on one side and Lesby, who had a pretty good Final Four,
yep.
good season their senior year. So he developed, but watching him may have been a little bit more unconventional. It was more in the club scene. We went to a few of the high school games, but watching, you know, games that are 22-1 and, you know, he's got a lot of points. You can't put a lot of stock into that
right.
because of the, you know, the quality.
So within a 24-month window, you win a national championship, you open a stadium, and you join a league that has different standards academically as well as what you're able to do from a transfer standpoint, and particularly from a grad transfer standpoint, where that had been I remember that being more of a early hallmark than at a lot of other institutions, right? Like, you know, I know Duke was pretty successful from a grad transfer standpoint, Georgetown a little bit as well. But you guys had a run of one or two contributors pretty much every year for 5 or 6 years in a row. And then that kind of became a much more difficult thing to do in the Patriot League. So how do you describe kind of the way that flipped in such a short span of time?
Yeah. You know, we really didn't talk about it an awful lot back then. I mean, we still had ECAC teams competing in the Patriot League. And so we felt like we were in a really good position, right, early on. And our record would bore that out. I think where it became a little bit of a challenge is, you know, certainly, you know, and I talk out of both sides of my mouth. Because what I love about not being able to go into the portal and find those fifth-year guys, we have to develop our guys. And we think that's something that we do really well here is that, you know, we get them here and we develop them. But, you know, the only fifth years that we are allowed to have are young men that graduate.
Your own, yeah.
Right? Yeah, a medical redshirt. We can't even redshirt. So a medical redshirt would bring them that fifth year outside of COVID where everybody gets the fifth year.
Right.
So, yeah, it changed us a little bit. Probably we have bigger freshman class numbers. We probably, you know, feel like spending more time in the development phase in the off season is important to us. And you can't just change your locker room, you know, as quickly. You still can go to the portal. I don't want to say that we can't go find a freshman or somebody that's just finishing their sophomore year. But it's really hard to go into the portal and find those guys that are going to be program changers, right? You might find a guy that wants to come home or somebody that's been playing short stick and now he's always wanted to be the pole and it's just not working out. And so, yeah, we'll still continue to keep a small eye on it. But I would tell you that we're not spending a ton of time in the portal like we used to.
And how about in terms of the role that the academic component of it plays from the standpoint of who you can have a conversation with and who you can't?
Yeah, for sure. I would tell you, you know, I could go back in the early stages when we were in the ECAC, you were looking for academic qualifiers, right? And you couldn't have a whole team of them.
Right.
You could find a guy that you're like, we're going to take a chance on this young man because we know we have an academic support system and a coordinator that's just going to allow them to be successful, put them in a position, right? Study halls and things like that. That changed, obviously. Now you're recruiting to an academic index. So now, you know, a combination of your GPA and your SAT, and there's a sliding scale and they got to hit a number. And, you know, if we had to look at guys and say no. And that, you know, again, was very early changing our recruiting, right? Like now the conversations of we need a transcript soon. Like we need to talk to your coaches, we need to talk to your club coaches to find out what type of guy you are, what you want to do, right? And the one thing that I really liked about it was it probably forced us into some longer conversations about whether or not it was going to be the right fit. More challenges, right? We're trying to fight with Ivies. We're trying to fight with other schools that maybe we weren't competing with, you know, in the academic side of things early on. But that's a good thing. Right? Like the academic success of the program, you know, and what we can, now we have the ability to go in to a young man's living room or have that first phone call and say, this is our team GPA, right? Like, it's pretty, it's up there. And that we're talking to you, but there are a lot of guys like you in the locker room. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not the outlier, you know? And so, and I always use the example, like, I'll be the first guy, you know, when here, I probably would not be here in the Patriot League.
Right.
And there's a lot of us, but, you know, the flip side of it is, you know, this thing was built on, you know, you talk about Ridley and you talk about, you know, the commitment to the sport they play, whether or not that's academic support or facilities or one-on-one connections with the teachers. Like, there's that, we're going to always come back to that blue collar mentality that, you know, maybe we don't have all the bells and whistles, but we've got the things that are going to help you to be successful in life, right? Like, we've got the things that are going to help you win. And they're going to point a finger at the sport you play to be successful. And, oh, yeah, by the way, we've done it. We've been back to the Final Four when nobody said you have the ability to do this. In 2016, you'd
right.
be back with none of the players. And then again, in 2019, I think, or 2021, I'm sorry, you know, you're back with within a goal to go back to the Final Four again
yeah.
with the new team. You know, those are things that we kind of tend to talk about.
For sure. Well, so I don't want to skip over it. I do think that to the point about evolution and eras, the post 2017 rule change with respect to early recruiting, I want to dive in on how that changed things a little bit. But what happened in between 2012 and 2017 is you committed Pat Spencer. He local guy, you know, very famously, I want to frame this as a question. He's billed as a late bloomer, but there's also the reality that, like, he was at a program with, like, Shaq Stanwyck, and maybe it wasn't so much that he was a late bloomer as it was that there were just a lot of really talented players that played his position in front of him. How do you kind of describe that, both from the standpoint of how much better Pat got between when you guys started recruiting him and then, you know, ultimately what everybody kind of knew he was by the time his high school career was over. And then some of the other factors that led to him being a Greyhound.
Yeah. I mean, I think that some people would tell you that was the secret sauce of Loyola. Like, we just didn't get involved in a lot of the eighth grade recruiting, ninth grade recruit. We just didn't do it. We felt like we needed to find a more developed guy. And, you know, certainly in Pat's case, the stories out there, you know, he did play JV when a lot of those guys were playing varsity. And so the ball's in his stick. And, you know, everybody knows that he grew exponentially, you know, from his junior year to his senior year. But then again, in his senior year in high school to getting here, he just hit a magnificent growth spurt. But the one thing that you knew that I loved, and I'm a graduate of the same program, is
right.
He plays a high-level game. He's playing against quality opponents, and he's well-coached. And, you know, he was a leader, you know, in his junior and senior year. And so in some ways, it was good for us that other programs got out of the way very early when they were looking, and he's going to prospect days and he's just a little smaller than some of the other guys. And then all of a sudden, you know, for him being a local guy, being able to watch basketball games and playing at a really high level, took them to a championship. You know, I thought it gave us a leg up because one, we're recruiting against half the field now. And two, he is, anybody that knows Pat, he's a family guy. And so his ability to have his grandparents in the stands on a Saturday Green Gray scrimmage, or, you know, a midweek game, he's a homebody. And, I felt like at that point we had some success. And so we were still in a position to kind of attract guys to campus. And it just worked out well. I mean, we were blessed. He was a program changer. And, you know, he still is. You know, his name still resonates out there with a lot of young recruits that we talk to. It's probably the first thing they say, well, what do you know about Loyola? I know Pat Spencer, you know. And so we're still playing off of that. And the idea that, you know, we've had Twerton guys.
Yes.
Multiple, right? Like a defender, a Michael Sawyer in 2012. And then obviously Pat, like, we've developed our guys that might not have been the can't miss guys that you take, you know, really early in their class. Pat developed, his game got better. is probably one of the most competitive people that has ever been in my locker room, for sure. And to this day, you know, he is a voice for us out there. He will help in any way possible. Still loved his experience here. May wish that he played basketball a little bit, but he played down at the inner city all summer long. Like, he kind of threw away our strength and conditioning, and that was his strength and conditioner, which, by the way, hard to say it didn't work.
Totally. Yeah, it's an interesting point, and it's one I'm going to give a shout out to Ryan Agabrody, who, a longtime member of the athletic department here at Loyola, and somebody who I think has a landscape-wide view, and he and I have had the conversation about the role that Pat's visibility played in extending the reach of the program, even relative to winning a championship. And it's kind of, I think it helps me understand a little bit more what the mindset of a typical 16-year-old is, which is, you know, a lot of them want to win championships, but a lot of them also want to be stars. And to be able to show that you can come to Loyola and be a star has a lot of value in a way that I don't know that I would have understood had that not been explained to me that way. And I think that's a really interesting legacy for a guy to leave on a program.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the one thing that you have to have is a platform to allow them to do that, right? So who you're playing, what it looks like, you know, in terms of the game day experience, how much the school pairs. But yes, I mean, he's a generational talent. And, you know, to have him here and, you know, I mean, how many schools can say they've had three NBA guys in the same class, but unfortunately they only played 17 games or 11 games together.
Right.
Right. So yeah, I mean, we were hoping, to be honest with you, on the back end of it, that Cam would finish his basketball career and then we'd get him to come back, because I remember watching him as a crab thinking, man, we could get the sibling on this one, and when Pat's leaving, maybe he's checking in and he's talented. But that didn't happen.
No, the Memphis Grizzlies came calling. Yeah,
UConn and Rutgers.
So you brought it up, but I want to go a little deeper on it. The notion that Loyola was very successful, and not the only program, but probably at the highest level, recruiting in an era when the traditional top 10 programs were committing a lot of eighth graders and ninth graders, because you were taking more fully formed players. Do you think that the implementation of not being able to contact high school players until September 1st of their junior year has effectively removed an advantage that you had?
Yeah, you can go back to the INLCA vote, and I voted against it. And I only voted against it because we didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I always like to use the analogy, fat guys at the buffet table. You know, if somebody goes and you're sitting at a game, you know, your eye is drawn to the most talented player. And if that's in eighth grade and you were to recruit that guy, you're probably thinking, okay, I'm going to get a head out, you know, on all these other programs, and we'll go that direction. And I would tell you that, you know, it's forced us to do more homework. It's got us into some different recruiting battles. And we got to learn to fight, you know, the Big Ten and the ACC, the Ivies, you name it, everyone, because that window starts September 1st of their freshman year. And we've got to have a list of guys that are the right kind of guys for us. And where that has probably been most impactful is the amount of conversations that you're having with club coaches and high school coaches, the front end, you know, homework that you have to do to make sure that you've got the right guys, the guys that are going to be, you know, in your wheelhouse if you sign.
And I think that Ryan McNulty is a good example of the type of kid who could have gone anywhere and chose Loyola and this is the type of thing I can only say in this conversation because I only went to college one place. He chose Loyola for what Loyola offered. And I think that's the point that you're trying to make with respect to getting him on campus. How does that continue to manifest? And I guess the question that I'm asking is, like, is there just a lot of luck involved with respect to where the kids that you want are from, what high schools they went to, what their academic profile is? And if those things are aligned, then you can get them. But on the other hand, like, if the class just doesn't go that way for whatever reason, right? Like, you know, if it's a particularly low academic class, you know, that can be a disadvantage. If it's a class that's particularly good in a place where you don't traditionally get a lot of kids from that area, then that could be a hindrance. Like, how do you just I guess my question is it luck or is there something that can be controlled?
I think it's a little of both.
Yeah.
You know, I would tell you that, you know, we've had success with some club programs, you know, that have continuously said you need to look down there and you need to go visit it. Like, don't rule that out. Same with some high school programs. You know, they know who we are. They know the staff. They know how much, you know, the university cares. And they're like, you know, you may be thinking of this, but why wouldn't you? What are you worried about seeing? Take that look. And so where you might not get that in the non-traditional area, you probably have to work a little harder to educate some of the club coaches and high school programs as to who we are. Again, I think, you know, winning a championship and having a Pat Spencer, so like people kind of know now. We don't have to worry about that as much. But the front end conversations, you know, I think are probably what's the biggest difference, because, you know, I've always said my biggest thing when I first got here was a pet peeve of mine that we would be playing up on Curly Field and all the youth in Baltimore was coming to watch us play, whether or not it was a local school down the street in Johns Hopkins or a Duke that was on our schedule back then. You know, all the little guys wore their jerseys, and we have to change that first. We have to play a quality and a style, and the quickest way to change that is to have some local talent that Baltimore knows that wants to watch play. So I probably focused a little bit there. But yeah, I mean, we're very fortunate in geographically to be in the area that we are, where there's quality lacrosse, you know, and then obviously the traditional hotbeds, you know, of your Long Island and your Syracuse, your upstate, with the advent of, you know, New Jersey and Philly. But then, okay, we're all fighting for those guys. Let's go to Atlanta. You know, let's go find a young man in the Midwest. Texas is on fire right now. California right. On fire. You know, so you have to expand that footprint. And fortunately, we've been able to do that, as all programs have. But the quality of lacrosse has been amazing to watch.
So to the point about the benefit of being later when you were recruiting juniors as opposed to your competitors recruiting freshmen, how is there an analogy with respect to like September 1st speed? You know, we're recording this on September 10th, and there are a handful of programs that have already committed, you know, 5, 6, 7 guys. It almost feels like they're almost done with their class. Is there value kind of in a similar way to being a little bit more patient, because whether it's the benefit of time or just like, all right, we're going to have a clear view of the landscape 15 days into September relative to if we just put the pedal to the metal on the first?
Yeah, I think, you know, just about every program could be done if they want really early. I think I always say that, you know, programs probably recruit to the temperament of their coaching staff,
yeah,
their head coaches. You know, there are coaches that want to take their time that see the benefit of recruiting a later class. You know, I feel like we are kind of somewhere in the middle now. And again, I go back to, you know, it may change with your staff. It may change with the integrity of, you know, the war room when you're sitting in there and you're putting your list together. You know, there are kids that are going to be early guys. And you've got to, if you want to get in the battle, you've got to fight the battle. And so, you know, again, it's a situation where you've got to educate you on the front end, you know, with the club coaches and the high school coaches as to this is what we're looking for. What's the, you know, what's the market for him, and where you fit in that market probably depends on how early you feel like you need to go. I will always say, you know, I love the idea of having one or two spots, you know, and the ability to find that late bloomer. And you're also recruiting to your locker room.
Yeah.
I mean, 2 years ago, we needed 19 freshmen. We graduated 21 people. You know, we came out of COVID. We were two classes in that last class. So 19 freshmen's a lot. So you're going to naturally have a really long process for that class. This class is going to be a little smaller. And so, you know, our priority is to kind of create that list, get guys on campus. But as soon as that list kind of winds down, okay, let's take a pause. Let's recognize what November recruiting is about. We don't have to go in and make decisions then. It probably hasn't been in their hands if they're the type of guys that are two-sport athletes.
Right.
And maybe it'll play out till next summer. So
I think we try to find that balance, you know, of early and late.
And so that sets up, I got two questions. They're both very timely and topical, which I think is a good place to end, kind of fitting the theme of evolution. So the first is this notion of the house settlement and a 48 player roster cap. Patriot League schools, as far as I understand, in total did not opt in. Is that
correct?
Yeah. So what does that mean? What type of flexibility does that give you, and what type of limitations do you foresee?
Yeah. Again, I think it's year one, so we're kind of still finding out what that looks like. Obviously, the advantage right now, I would tell you, is that we're allowed to have a larger locker room. You know, so currently we've got about 54 in our locker room. We don't have to protect 48 guys and worry about the grandfathered players that are there. What will that look? What will that mean in the portal? Will that have younger players in the portal next year? I don't know. I mean, that's not something that I think we're going to bank on and look to kind of make a move towards. But yeah, so having a larger locker room, you know, kind of until I start to bears out, like, what does the revenue sharing look like how that impacts us? I haven't felt that so far on the phone calls. I haven't felt that, you know, certainly with club coaches, that you're just not in it because of X, Y, Z.
Because of dollars. Right.
Yeah, because of straight out cash. And you know, I think time will tell on that. I'd like to get 2 or 3 years in to really be able to dive in and say, how has this impacted our program? Because I haven't felt it yet.
Yeah. And then the last question is, we've talked about him a fair amount already, but Justin Ward arrives as a offensive coordinator. A couple things distinguish him from Mark Van Arsdale, his predecessor. Chiefly, he went here, so he can speak to the experience very directly. But then secondly, he comes from Army, where, you know, number one, he was in league, so he was competing against Loyola. But number two, very uniquely, they were able to start talking to high school players on July 1. So now, you know, he goes through the transition of having knowledge of what that experience was like, while also then applying the lessons learned in terms of, as you said, the speed of the market, so to speak. What's Justin brought to the table?
Yeah, I think having been a coach that's worked at the Naval Academy myself, you have to identify the market, right? Like the kids. So the relationships that he has with the club coaches and with the high school coaches, I think that's been the first thing that I've noticed. So we've been able to do a really good job of vetting, you know, the right guys for us. And Justin, you know, really kind of, I guess, in the meeting said, this is kind of the way I think it can be really good for us. And so, you know, we are all, everybody made phone calls, but I think it's just a little bit more disciplined as though, all right, you're calling these 20 coaches this week and you're going to call these 20 coaches, and we got to follow back up with them because now they're going to have conversations with their players. What's the market? You know, what does this look like? In an idea of, we've got to have our list a little more narrowed and defined. Make it a little bit more of a personal experience. Get to know these guys. Whereas maybe last year for me, it may have been on September 1st, a 15 to 20 minute window of scheduling calls. This year was very different. It was 30 minutes. And it, most of the calls could have gone as long as 22, 27 minutes. Just really having to take the time to get to know who's on the other end and allowing them the time to understand my vision for our program and what this, you know, why we think we're on the phone with him and not a lot of other guys, you know. So again, it was easy to do because of the front end work that Justin brought to us. Just very disciplined, you know, and again, narrowing and defining what we want offensively, you know, for him. Again, a righty stretch shooter, a lefty wing guy. Justin wants Justin at the X, right? He wants a guy that can kind of learn to become a thrower or learn to become a scorer. Right? He was a guy that was a very talented feeder that we challenged to become a goal scorer. And he did it very well towards the end. I think that's the type of, you know, recruiting board that we're looking at is what slot do they fit in? Is it a midi that might be best suited to be in that slot, you know? And so it's really been fun. You know, we don't have the ability to just roll the ball out and say, this is how we're going to play, you know, let's go, right? We've got to play a certain style. Patriot League is unique, right? Everybody would tell you it's a really good face-off league and it's a really good riding league, you know, a lot of 10 mans. So we've got to identify talent that's going to allow us to compete, certainly in league and the challenges of that. But we also want to play a style that other people have to kind of get used to. And so, yeah, I mean, whether or not it's that or it's the 2-3 cover defensively, it's are we taking a short stick or are we going to take an offensive middie and turn him into a short stick? Because we've had success in both ways. But I would tell you that, you know, a lot of programs are really valuing, and probably since 2012 when we had a rope unit that was very stingy, you know, a lot of people look at that position a little differently. And certainly I can remember in 2016, I want to say, was it 16 or 19, Albany coming here, we had the number one offense and they had, I'm sorry, defense, and they had the number one offense and they were going to play two-way middies and not let those guys get on the field. And it was rough. It was a bear of a day for us. And, you know, so there are different ways to play and you just have to recruit to whatever your vision for your program is. And Justin's really done a good job of challenging us and really giving us what his vision offensively can look like for Loyola. And for me, I'm very comfortable with it because it's the vision of the 2012 team where we had a lot of success.
Totally. Charlie Toomey, it's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to have you here, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.